Welcome to season 4 of the Ultimate Birth Partner podcast. I am Sally Ann Beresford, a birthkeeper, author, and antenatal educator. My mission is to ensure that pregnant women and anyone who supports them feels well prepared for birth on a deep level. This podcast's aim is to offer knowledge and wisdom on topics that will help you discover not only how to step into your power and achieve your dream birth, but know why it is so important to you. Hello and welcome to part one of a two-part series of Helen's story, the difference between her first birth in part one and her second birth at home in part two. The journey Helen went on in the 8 years between her two children is quite incredible, and I hope you enjoy listening to this transformation because Helen has so much to share, so much wisdom to offer. She also talks about how she prepared her partner for this birth and what a difference it made to them. This is a fascinating journey, one which I hope really inspires you to learn more about stepping into your power and doing some inner work in order to achieve your dream birth. Enjoy. Helen, it's so lovely to have you on the podcast. We met last year on an online course, and obviously you became pregnant quite soon afterwards. So it's been really lovely to follow your journey, and I'm excited to hear more about how your story developed. So would you like to just start by introducing yourself?
Thank you. Yes, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me on. Yes, so I'm Helen. I run Totem Healing. I have a little studio nearby where I live, and I don't really like labels, but I suppose I class myself as a spiritual mentor. I'm a Reiki master teacher, so I do a lot of training people in the energy healing modality of Reiki, and I'm a Reiki drum master as well. So I use the drum. I teach meditation. I do womb healing, all sorts of different things, quantum energy healing as well. So a healing facilitator, I guess you could call me, with a mix of modalities. Yeah. And it was lovely to connect with you. And I thought straight away when we spoke and I watched you on the course talking about what you do, and you were so passionate about it. And I remember going, wow, yeah. And there was something you said about how people invest in weddings, but yet they don't invest in birth and labor and pregnancy as much. And I was like, wow, that's really, yeah, that makes so much sense. And I'd not really thought about it in that way before. So yes, I did become pregnant. I think we weren't even at the end of the course, and I did reach out to you and just say, oh, can I call on you throughout this if I need any help? Which you've been very gracious throughout the whole pregnancy and really been there for me at times when I've been like, oh, I don't know what to do, or what do I think about this? So firstly, thank you for that. That's really lovely.
You're welcome. I mean, most of that stemmed from your first birth experience, didn't it? Because I remember you talking to me about how your first birth had gone and how it had affected you. Do you want to share that story with us? Is that okay?
Yeah, of course. So basically, my first little girl, she's now 8, so 8 years ago, and I wasn't doing what I do now. So I wasn't kind of on the spiritual path. I had Reiki before, and I'd done a few things, but I certainly wasn't as involved in that journey as I am now. And I started the pregnancy was fine. I quite enjoyed it. I was quite sick at the beginning of pregnancy, which lasted, I remember it lasting longer than a lot of women say theirs did. I think it was possibly up to about 18, 20 weeks. But other than that, it was fine until towards the end, and I started to worry about movements. So I did go into triage, I think it was about 3 or 4 times with reduced movement. Now, I understand now that it was because I wasn't as in tune with my body. So I wasn't able to kind of tap in as I did this time and go, is everything okay? Yes, it is. There's nothing to worry about. Not saying that other people shouldn't get it checked out, but I just, with your first as well, you're always a little bit more on edge and worried about things a lot more, I think. So yeah, so I went in with reduced movement quite a few times. And then towards, she'd always been measuring slightly on the bigger scale. And then my last couple of growth scans, they said she was going to be a big baby. So we had the big baby syndrome. And they said she was going to be way over 10 pounds. So they advised, I remember going in for the last growth scan, and they tried to get me to stay in. I think I must have been about 38, 39 weeks. And they tried to get me to stay in to be induced on that day. And they said, oh, you know, Mike can just go back and get the stuff and just stay here. And I was like, that doesn't feel right. I don't really want to do that. I don't feel ready. I'd rather give baby a little bit more time. So they kind of, I did sit with the consultant, and I did feel pressured to be induced. Like I said, they tried to get me to be induced earlier on. And then in the end, I agreed to being induced on my due date, so that at least I it was kind of due date time.
Yeah.
They convinced me to have a sweep the day before, because I said, you know, is there anything else I can do? Because although I wasn't nearly as clued up as I am now, I still felt that it was being rushed. So they said, you know, have a sweep the day before and that might bring on labor. So this, it came to the day before the sweep. I did have a midwife come to me, and it was the most painful thing. Really, really horrible. She did say I was slightly dilated already, so I was hopeful that would bring things on. But the induction was the following morning. I had to go in, and nothing had really started or changed. I remember being really excited about being there, because, you know, I had the date, I knew when she was coming. And yeah, I remember being in the ward, and then it was only us there to start with. And I was bouncing on the ball and doing all the things that you think you're supposed to do. And then they came and put the first pessary in. Now, I had 3 pessaries because the first 2 fell out when I went to the toilet. And having the pessaries inserted was also the most painful thing. I just found it really horrendous. I didn't like it at all. So then each time when they fell out and I knew I had to have it again, that was putting me under even more stress.
Yeah.
Then what started to happen is I immediately got cluster contractions, which were straight away very painful.
Mm.
So I was finding that I wasn't getting a break in between, and they were getting more and more and more intense. And this was still really early on.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, if this is what it's like now. I had initially wanted to have a natural birth, and I didn't want pain relief or as little as possible. But I thought, you know, I'll have the gas and air, because it was just becoming very, very painful. I was in that ward for about 24 hours, just dealing with these cluster contractions and nothing really moving. I wasn't dilating, which of course I understand now. Of course I wasn't, because I had all these kind of fake hormones going through me and my body was already in that fight or flight because of the pain. And I remember feeling that it didn't feel natural at the time. And yeah, so I was there for about 24 hours. They did give me a morphine injection as well. So I had some morphine for the pain. The following day that they said, look, you've been here so long. I think I was dilated maybe to about four or five. And they were waiting till I was six to take me down. But they said, we're going to take you down anyway, because you've been here so long and nothing seems to be progressing. By that point, I was in so much pain, hadn't slept, was getting pretty delirious. I remember going down in a wheelchair. And when I got into that delivery room, things come and go. I don't remember all of it, but I remember I was then monitored on the bed. So then I kind of was strapped a little bit. I do remember I must have been able to at some point get on my hands and knees, because I remember I was there and I have this image of myself holding on to the bars and making the noises that you make, mm-hmm. Those kind of guttural animalistic sounds that start to come. But I was having those and still nothing was happening. So I was kind of, oh, and also that my waters hadn't broken, because my body was so tensed, I wasn't able to go to the loo. So they then had to break my waters. And I remember seeing the kind of hook thing that they use. And it was so painful. So I was already going through, it felt traumatic, those hours. And I wasn't really with it, because I was in there for about three days. And I'd said no epidural. But the anaesthetist had come down. I think they were just going off duty when I moved down into the delivery suite. And then they came back on duty the next day, whenever it was. And I remember him saying to me, you must have a really high pain threshold, because you're still here and haven't had an epidural. And it was at that point that I think Mike was getting really concerned, and he was feeling really out of control, didn't know how to help me. I was not with it at all by then, really, and just still having these intense, horrid cluster contractions with no baby. And he kind of murmured to me, and I think I must have agreed in some way to have the epidural. So they did the epidural, and because of what I'd gone through, I'm very glad I did have it at that point, because I needed it then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because my body had gone through so much by that point. I just needed that relief, and it was a relief. So I remember sitting in bed after that and having like a cup of tea and the toast before baby had come, but just to kind of give me that. And I think I had a little bit of a sleep. But I was very aware. I kept dialing it down, because I wanted to be able to feel a little bit of what was happening. I wanted to retain a little bit of that control. So even then, I understood a little bit, not as much as I obviously know now. And then she was born. Oh gosh, I've just forgotten what time she was born. I think she was born at about, it was 2:17 in the morning of that third day. So towards the end, I remember them telling me to start pushing. I think I'd actually said, I feel like now's the time. And actually, just thinking back over it now, I think they thought I wasn't ready yet, but I felt that I was. So we did start pushing, and then they said her heart rate dropped. So I remember the consultant coming in, and he just didn't have a nice vibe. I didn't enjoy his vibe at all. He was very forceful, let's get this done. And I remember even seeing the midwife and she didn't look happy. So he said they were going to give me an episiotomy.
Do you have a copy of my books yet? These award-winning, best-selling books are changing lives for tens of thousands of couples across the world as they are bridging the gap between what you learn on a standard antenatal education program and what actually happens in the birth room. Labour of Love, The Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner, is fondly described as the Bible for partners. This book is intended to be read by the pregnant woman and her partner so that they both recognise how fundamental their role is to her success when planning, preparing, and giving birth to her baby. It offers a level of education that is not typically taught and shares hundreds of tips learned on my journey as a professional birth partner for over 20 years. In my book, The Art of Giving Birth, I am focusing specifically on physiological birth. So many of you are desperate to achieve an unmedicalized birth, but don't know how. Throughout the chapters, I share my five key principles, which will advance the knowledge you already have and support you and your partner to really understand what it takes to give birth physiologically. The first chapter of this book is available as a free download. You can find the link in the show notes or in my link tree on Instagram. I have also created a journal to accompany this book, specifically to help support the process of identifying who you are as a person and what areas you might need to work on in order to overcome some of the common obstacles faced within the maternity system. The work that comes from not only reading The Art of Giving Birth, but carrying out the suggestions within will guide you from knowing what you want to achieve to actually having the confidence to do it. Lastly, I have designed a journal with a variety of different cover options to suit all that are aimed at planning and preparing for birth in general, which make great gifts for anyone who loves to make lists, document their pregnancy journey, and explore their feelings. All of my books and journals are available to order now from Amazon across the world or any online bookstore by typing my name, Sally Ann Beresford, into the search engine at the top, or you can get copies direct from me, Sally Ann at birthability.co.uk, or DM me on Instagram at The Ultimate Birth Partner. If you already have a copy, I would be so grateful if you could leave a rating and review to help others find my books and journals. This is so important so that others can benefit from the knowledge and wisdom shared within the pages. Now back to this episode.
So he did the cut, and Mike remembers him declaring something like, oh dear, or Mike felt that his words are, botched the episiotomy slightly. So it was clear that something had not quite gone as it should have. And then he decided that they needed to use the forceps to get her out. So she was born, and I remember they checked her over, and then I did hold her. But it was kind of so overwhelming because the journey to get to that point that she didn't even feel like mine.
Yeah.
I didn't have that immediate, oh my gosh, this is amazing, I love my baby kind of moment. And I think that's important because a lot of women feel scared to say that because of this idea that you have to immediately fall in love with your baby and there's that immediate bond that you've been looking for. But I think when your body has gone through a certain amount of trauma, you're kind of coming out of that fight or flight, aren't you? And you just need that moment of breath and relief. And all I wanted to do was sleep. So I know she was then taken to be weighed and to do what they do. And then I think Mike had her for a bit, and I just remember sleeping, and I must have slept for, I think she did sleep as well, to be fair. I must have slept for an hour or two. Yeah, but I didn't, like, with hope, I wanted to keep hold of her the whole time. And I didn't feel that with Amelia. And I've had a lot of guilt since then about that. But I know it is quite common for women who go through trauma in birth.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was, and then after I'd given birth and you know, we stayed there for a little bit. I remember staying overnight in the ward, which was horrendous, and struggling to breastfeed, being in such a stressful state that the latching wasn't coming easy. And I called Mike back in the middle of the night, I think, because I needed some kind of support. And the midwives, they're just there doing their job. I know they're busy on wards, so you know it's not necessarily their fault. It's just you're kind of left to it. And as a new mom, first time mom, it's scary, really scary. So after, I remember the feeling in the car home is a really strange one for me. I remember that empty feeling in your belly, and going over the bumps, and I found it horrendous. I was struggling to walk at all. Over the next couple of days, I developed the water retention, a lot of water retention in my legs and in my ankles and my feet. I had infections down where the episiotomy was. So I literally couldn't find any position where I could sit comfortably. So then trying to breastfeed was more difficult. I then developed mastitis. And I remember just sitting and crying. Those first kind of 5 days, all I remember doing is crying and feeling completely overwhelmed, out of control, and not knowing where to get the answers or who to turn to. And Mike was constantly on the phone to midwives, to the hospital, asking for help. And there just didn't, no one seemed to have any, they kept saying, just keep doing what you're doing. And I know, like, that's fine, but it's not particularly helpful when you're in that situation. So yeah, so it wasn't a fun time. And from there, I then developed postnatal depression, and then I discovered later on I also had PTSD from the birth. And the length of time it had been that I'd been in that trauma mode. So yeah, and I was on antidepressants then for about 5 years before I managed to come off. So yeah, so that's kind of the story from my first birth. Amelia, I must say, is thriving and is a beautiful, confident young girl. And I think what positives that came from that was, I was very open to other people holding her, and I passed her over a lot more, but it meant she was very used to being with different people, lots of family, which I wouldn't choose and have chosen to do this time, but I can understand that it's, you know, as she grew, she has been very independent and very confident. So I am grateful for that.
I have a question about what you were given, because you've not mentioned being given any drugs through a drip to stimulate your contractions. Do you remember if that occurred?
I think it did, yes.
The reason I ask, Helen, is because when you're given an epidural, particularly throughout an induction, it usually accompanies the synthetic hormone oxytocin. So we would call that syntocinon. In America, that's pitocin. And what that does is it literally knocks out your own body's ability to produce that hormone naturally. So it's a very, very common issue that women don't feel an immediate connection with the baby at the time of birth, because actually their hormones are just replaced by the synthetic version. And so little is known about this. And it should be spoken about because it would not necessarily change the decision to have the drug in the event that you wanted to progress the labour and just get it over with and have the baby. But you would have had a very different viewpoint as to how you felt afterwards, because you would say, ah, the reason I felt that way in those early moments, hours, days, weeks, and for many people, months, is because I didn't have my own production of oxytocin.
Yeah.
And when you understand that, you feel less guilty. You can handle that information. You can move forward in a very different way. But a lot of women have the perception that there's something wrong with them, and they blame themselves for not feeling an immediate connection with the baby. And it's very understandable. So your fluid levels in your body were quite high, which is why you had, you know, some inflammation symptoms and you had a lot of fluid. And again, that is caused by the fluids that are pumped into you during labor. So a lot of people, again, suffer symptoms that they don't really fully understand. But again, it's a side effect of the drugs that they're given. And so, yeah, it is really interesting, isn't it, how it can affect you. I mean, you ended up on antidepressants, which is a major thing to overcome, because in the immediate time, it will have supported you. But trying to come off of them is a whole nother experience. So well done you for all that you went through and, you know, how you managed to eliminate that in the end. 5 years is a long time, but eventually you found yourself in a position to get off of those drugs. I wonder what happened in those 5 years and what led up to Hope's pregnancy. Do you want to share that with us?
Yeah, it's quite complicated, a long story, but I'll dial it down as much as I can to give you the details. So, yes, so not long after we'd had Amelia, I think she may have been a couple of years, we unfortunately were victims of fraud and identity theft. And at the time, my husband, Mike, was an actor. I was in the performing arts industry. So I ran my own professional theatre company. I ran a stage school for children, and I produced shows and directed them, toured nationally around the country. And I'd also started entering into film as well. So I'd directed and produced a short film, which actually got into about 7 different international film festivals. And I took it to New York to a festival there where it did really well. So I was in a very different place. And through this industry, we were given the opportunity to move to the US. And we left our life down south. As you can tell from my accent, I'm not from the Warrington area where I live now. So I was down south. We moved, Mike was down there with me. We moved up here, which is where his parents live, because we were told we were going to be flying out from there. So we kind of literally left our life. I sold my business, which I'd created and built since I was like 23. I'd run my own businesses. And unfortunately, it took another 7 months of us living out of suitcases here at his parents' before we actually boarded a plane. And then once we got there, we were put in a hotel while our house was getting ready. And unfortunately, we were still affected by the fraud, which we thought had been sorted. Clearly, it wasn't. And we were told that the people that were trying to help us over there weren't allowed to help us. And we ended up being in this hotel, being told that we had to pay these huge bills. Our cards stopped working. Everything was halted. And this was about, it hit its worst a couple of days before Christmas. Bear in mind, we had Amelia, who was, I think she was about 3.5, 4. So someone managed to pay for us to stay Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. So we had somewhere, but we had no money, no access to anything. Everything was just stopped through no fault of our own. And the day after, we were told again that we needed to leave the hotel. And we found ourselves in LA in this hotel foyer with all our suitcases, just not knowing what to do. And I remember one of the lowest points was me begging the hotel waiter, who had been really kind to us, for some toast for Amelia, because we just didn't have any other option. And then I remember walking to a different area of the hotel, and I sat and I prayed. I literally prayed like I'd never prayed before, called on everything and anything I could think of, and just asked for a miracle, because they were telling us we had to leave the hotel. And if we didn't do something, we were going to be on the streets with our 3.5, 4-year-old. So the only thing, and our parents couldn't help us. They were desperately trying, because our accounts were frozen. They couldn't get anything to us. So they were besides themselves as well. Luckily, I'd made friends with this lady out there who had a little girl a similar age, and she'd given me her phone number. So as a last resort, I actually phoned her and basically begged for her to take us in just while we sorted this stuff out. So we managed to stay with her for a night, and then she very kindly put us up in a motel, because she had a very small place, so we couldn't really stay there. She had loads of dogs, I remember. We couldn't really stay there longer than a night. So we were in this motel, and I remember feeling, I'd never felt more grateful for a roof over our heads, somewhere to sleep. And as part of the motel fee, you got like a continental breakfast. So we kind of just stored some of that food to keep us going. And what eventually happened, it was actually several weeks that we survived there. And Mike's parents managed to sell our car that we had over here to get enough money to get a flight back. Because we were like, we had people promising that they were still fixing things, but we were like, this is enough now. We need to go back.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a traumatic time as well. And bear in mind, I was already on antidepressants. I think I did move up to propranolol and anxiety medicine as well. So it was a very, very difficult time. But we were lucky that we had a close circle of support. We had a lot of people that didn't understand and doubted and questioned, and people that actually, unfortunately, are no longer friends of ours, not through our asking for that, but just through the circumstances. When we came back home, we both said, we have to make a change. Something needs to change. We can't go back to waiting like we were, to be told something was happening for this new life that we'd been promised. We had to let it go. And what I didn't mention as well is all our stuff, all our possessions that we built up over the years from our house had been shipped over to the US. We'd never seen it, and we still haven't received it. We still don't know where it is exactly.
Wow.
So we lost everything.
Everything.
Yeah, literally everything. So we said, okay, we're going to start again. And I remember going, because I'm quite good in survival mode. I go into, okay, what can we do? I can do this. You know, I've built up companies before. So I looked at what am I good at doing? And I immediately thought of Reiki. And I'd always felt that I could channel and work with energy even before I'd trained in Reiki. So I was actually already trained to Reiki level 1, which I'd done the previous year. So I'd started in those 7 months when we were here, I'd started doing yoga a lot. I'd started meditating a lot more. I was kind of pulling on all these tools to help me get through that time. And I'd done my Reiki level one. So I went, okay, if I can do my Reiki level two as soon as I get back, I can practice professionally. So that's exactly what I did. So I actually got my mother-in-law to book me on a course before I even got on the plane to get home.
Right.
So that I could straight away do that. And from there, it just blossomed and I started getting clients. I started going, okay, this is something that comes very naturally to me. And because I think I've always been able to hold space for people, I was a teacher teaching performing arts. I love teaching, and that kind of traveled through into my directing and producing. And because I could step back and see the bigger picture, made me a good director, which again was kind of running through into this therapy. And I found myself doing a lot more of the spiritual counseling side and actually helping people get to the bottom of the root cause of why they're feeling a certain way, not just with the Reiki. So, yeah, so I went on this journey and started building this business, which just again built naturally, and the clients came word of mouth, as you know, is the best way. And I started learning more and more and more, training in more healing modalities, and that's just built incredibly over the last 4 years really that I've been doing it properly. And then I decided to train as a Reiki master teacher, which meant I could then teach. And again, I now have people travel from all over the country to come and train with me, which I just find incredible. And I understand and realize that we had to go through everything we went through, one, to be able to understand what it's like to reach rock bottom after already being very low from the birth, the birth trauma. We had to reach rock bottom to be able to relate to other people that are coming to me for therapy, and also just to start this whole new life. And I now believe, and I have so many of my clients say, I'm so glad that you went through that and that you're now doing this, because this is what you're supposed to do. And I do truly believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you asked about Hope story, didn't you? So we come kind of to now, to a year ago. I was really kind of gearing up my career and the business and wanting to build, hence why I know we met on the online course. And then all of a sudden I discovered I was pregnant, and it was a bit of a surprise. I'd kind of thought, so I'm 42. I'd kind of thought, not that I was too old, but that it was done. And we've accepted that it was just the three of us. But we had a friend who became pregnant. And I don't know. I'd always said, you know, if it's meant to happen, then it will just happen. And I feel like that's the way it worked. But I know that it happened at the right time for me, because if it had happened before now, I wouldn't have been ready. The circumstance wouldn't have been right. We only just, so what I didn't say is when we came back from the US, obviously we were starting again from scratch. So we moved back in with Mike's parents, who have been very gracious to us. Yeah, so we actually lived with them for the last 4 years, and we shared a room with our daughter, with Amelia, and had everything in that room, really. Obviously, we had some stuff in the house, but it's not our house. So we only this July finally moved into our own place, which I'm so grateful for. But yeah, so it just, there was a reason it didn't happen before now. And again, you could say that I was starting to feel more confident and relax more. So maybe again, that's another reason. But it feels like, hence her name, Hope, gave us hope. She set off a series of events like dominoes that happened, good things that happened, like we suddenly got the house. Mike changed jobs. It seemed like there was lots of things that happened from me getting pregnant with her. So I know it was the right time, and I know it wasn't right before that. So yes, I was really happy. I was really happy. Mike wasn't expecting it at all. And actually, when I told him, he thought I was doing a prank. He genuinely thought I was joking, even when I showed him the stick. So yeah, it was a shock, but in a wonderful way. And I did struggle more with this pregnancy, interestingly enough. I found myself feeling more exhausted than I did, which could be a mixture of my age. And I was trying to work a lot still throughout the first trimester. But it really made me think, and it really made me open my eyes that first trimester, because I was like, why do women feel like they have to keep it a secret or not talk about that first trimester, where actually that's the time in pregnancy when you probably need the most support? So I actually started telling people a lot earlier than I did with Amelia. Again, I think it with your first, you worry, don't you, about things you're told, oh, don't say anything before 12 weeks, because this can happen and this can happen. But actually, if it does happen, surely for some people anyway, it would be better to have that support, to lift you up, to have those shoulders to cry on. I just found it really strange that I started going into that mode of, should we tell people? And then I was like, no, I need to be talking about it. And women need to feel safe and need to be able to say how horrible it is that first trimester, how I was really sick again till about week 20. I just felt horrible. And I didn't really enjoy that first part. And then I also started getting heavy bleeding at around week 11, which I'd never had before. So that was very scary. But again, I did a lot more. I started doing reading and research and finding out that actually, I think it's 1 in 4 women bleed during pregnancy, something like that. But it's actually way more common than we realize. But again, because it's not talked about, women immediately panic and fear the worst, which isn't helpful to your body either. So yeah, I know obviously that's when I got in contact with you, and I started reading your books as well, which, oh my gosh, are so amazing. But both of them, The Labor of Love and The Art of Giving Birth, I read both of them, and I encouraged Mike to read The Labor of Love as well, which he did. And just the understanding and the knowledge I then had from also your podcasts, listen to your podcasts, which I love. Yeah, it just opened my eyes so much. And I started, when I did start having the heavy bleeding, so at one point we actually thought we'd lost her, because the clots that I was passing were so large, and we actually were going in weekly for scans just to check everything was okay. But I started at that point, I think, looking at my previous birth, and that's when I drew on everything I've learned, all my healing modalities, and as well as the knowledge you've written in your books and the learning I was doing, and just started creating this different story for myself, healing that previous trauma, looking at what happened, why it happened, understanding it didn't have to happen, because I do truly believe that I did not need to be induced. Amelia, if you remember me saying, they were saying she was a big baby and going to be like way over 10 pounds. She was actually 8'13". So although she was a good size, she certainly wasn't big in my eyes. And she was, yeah, she was perfectly fine. So I really know now that I didn't need it, but you were made to feel that that is what you should do. So I did lots of work using all my modalities. I use belief coding as well. So I'm trained in belief coding as well, which is working with your subconscious mind. So going back over specific memories and making that kind of like in child healing, making that reflection, we call it in belief coding, that inner child, she's not a child, but you know what I mean, in that memory, feel safe and changing the way she feels at that time, which then helps to heal those ripple effects into the present moment. So I did a lot of that. And I also worked with Embrace Fertility. So I did some hypnotherapy and hypnobirthing, which I started, which I know you do as well. So yeah, I worked through a lot, and lo and behold, the bleeding stopped. And from that time, I actually started enjoying the pregnancy. And that stopped around, I think it was 18, 19 weeks. And although I still had some sickness most of the way through, there were no other issues. So yeah, so I just started to enjoy it.
So that's it for part one of Helen's story. And I'm really looking forward to next week's episode when Helen shares Hope's birth with us. Make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast or set a reminder on your phone, and you can listen to the remainder of this fantastic conversation. See you next week. Bye. Thank you so much for joining me on the Ultimate Birth Partner podcast and listening to this episode. I love having deep and thoughtful discussions about all things labour and birth. If you enjoyed it, please leave a rating and review and share it with your friends. If you want to receive a notification of the next episode, then don't forget to hit subscribe. If you would like to purchase either of the books that accompany this podcast, then head over to your online bookseller and search for Labour of Love, The Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner, or The Art of Giving Birth, 5 Key Physiological Principles. Follow me on Instagram at The Ultimate Birth Partner, and if you go to the link in my bio, you will find my Linktree page, which has all the links you need to access many of my services, including booking a course for you and your partner to learn how to succeed in achieving your dream birth.